space-time, in Minkowski space-time, is that there's an ambiguity in the choice of vacuum. Or equivalently, an ambiguity in the choice of the representation of the annihilation and creation operator algebra. And for free theory, this entire freedom is expressed in what we call a Bogoliubov or Bogoliubov transformation. I still don't know how to say it. Which, in its most general form, says that if I've got a set of creation annihilation operators, let me try and be a bit more careful. Let me call it AKAP, which satisfy these relations. With the A's commuting and the A decker's commuting, then I can also choose a different set of operators which are related by a Bogoliubov transform whose most general form takes the form where you have some coefficients alpha k q a q plus beta K Q A Q dagger. So it's a linear superposition of the creation and annihilation operators. And these things have to satisfy certain conditions that you can get by just working out the commutation relations for this guy and demanding that they look the same form. And what I'll do is just specialize to the case which is the case that you almost always use in cosmology, where these things are themselves proportional to delta functions, and so that this transformation is, so this is a simplified version, special case, where the transformation is just of the following form. So it's local in K space. So that's almost always the type of transformation we're going to use in cosmology. And I lost my train, what was I going to say? Yeah, and so in this particular case, plugging in these relationships, you can do that as an exercise for yourself. You find that these conditions are satisfied for the Bs and the associated B dagger, which is obviously, you don't really need an independent equation because you're just directly taking the dagger of this relationship. Satisfies as long as alpha squared, mod alpha squared, minus mod beta squared is 1. So this is essentially a condition of unitarity. In other words, that the norm of a state is preserved in time, or just the norm of the state is unity. So that's the freedom. And the point is that there are different vacua. There's the standard vacua we defined by what we can call the A vacua, which is the standard one you learn. But there's also an infinite family of B vacua, depending on your choice of coefficients alpha and beta, that you can also define in exactly the same way. And the whole creation annihilation operator logic just applies exactly the same. In particular, if I take the B vacuum and I act on it with the B creation operator, then this is going to create me, up to some normalization factor, a one-particle B state with momentum k, just as you learn in the standard picture. So why is it when we do field theory Minkowski space we don't talk about this freedom? And the reason is that, so there's always this ambiguity in the choice of vacuum, but at the end of the day, there has to be some physically sensible choice or physically appropriate choice to the problem you're dealing with. So in other words, the vacuum should be fixed by physics. So far we've really only fixed by physics. So far we've only been dealing with this mathematical formalism, but there's a missing point, which is some statement about the physics of the problem that should pick out a preferred vacuum. So what can that physics be? Well, one type of physics that naturally picks out a vacuum is when you have a symmetry, in particular a global symmetry. So remember, so only global symmetries are true symmetries. Local symmetries are just redundancies. Only a real symmetry is always a global symmetry. And when you do field theory in Minkowski space, you have a 10-parameter group of symmetries, which is known as the Poincaré algebra. So that's the group of translations with generators P mu, so that's 4, and then rotations with generators J, which is 3. This is a spatial index, that's a 4 index. And there's boosts, which are usually, and there's 3 of them, so that makes a total of 10 symmetries. So the existence of the symmetry picks out a preferred vacuum. And it's the one in which Poincaré invariance is unbroken. Yeah.
In string theory, it can happen that we have a large number of vacuums, and in that context, often we just don't care. We just live with a kind of state and vacuum, and we just but separate ladders. Why do we want exactly one vacuum?
Why do we want one vacuum? So here, there are different aspects of the vacuum choice. So in string theory, when we're talking about many different vacua, we're really talking about the many different. So you have a potential that looks something like this, and there are many different points at which you could be sat. You could be sat locally near here, or you could be sat locally near here. So there's a choice of vacuum, which here is just the simple choice, the classical choice of vacuum, which is where you're sat within the potential. So when string theorists, you know, when you talk about the landscape and you worry about where you are, what vacuum state you're in, they're usually talking about that purely classical choice. Whereas here we're going to the next stage, which is even once you've chosen your classical vacuum, there's a choice of the quantum vacuum state. We've got to specify the actual state for the quantum field. But even in string theory, you can have vacua that don't satisfy Runge invariance if you want to do that. Usually the existence of a symmetry, then you want to make the most of that symmetry. Okay, so what does this mean in practice? It basically means, so if you have a theory that's Poincaré invariant, then it should be that the correlators in the theory. So by correlators, we obviously mean things like expectation values of, say, phi of x and phi of y. These should be Lorentz invariant or Poincaré invariant, which means this must be a function of x and y, which is Lorentz invariant. And there's only one Lorentz invariant combination that we construct from x and y, which is the distance, which is the basically the proper distance in Minkowski space. So by that, so sometimes that's called sigma minus x minus y squared, which of course by literally you mean e to mu nu x mu y minus y mu x mu minus y nu. So this is the proper distance in Minkowski space between two points. So a simple way to say that if there exists a Poincaré invariant vacuum state, then all correlators, be they the two-point function, be they the three-point function, or so on and so on, should only be a function of Lorentz invariant combinations. In other words, of this distance. So that picks out a preferred vacuum, and that preferred vacuum was exactly the one we started with. So it was the one where we did the most naive thing, where we decomposed the fields into positive frequency and negative frequency modes. So if you remember the way the omegas, the A's were defined, was to split the field Tx, integral d3k over 2 pi cubed, 1 over square root 2 omega k, ak e to the I, k dot x minus I omega t, where omega k was the square root of k squared plus m squared, plus ak dagger minus I k dot x plus I omega t. So colloquially refer to these as the positive frequency modes. So mode is positive frequency if it goes like e to the minus I omega t, and these are the negative frequency modes. So if you compute this two-point function with that field, that's pretty simple to do. And you just, basically, because if you have the field 5y acting on 0, then A acting on the vacuum gives you nothing, so the only piece you pick out is this one. One over root 2 omega k, ak dagger acting on the vacuum. So phi on the vacuum essentially is a one-particle state. Plus I omega t. It's a one-particle state because we've got the creation operator acting on the vacuum. That picks out a one-particle state. And similarly, so the field is real. I'm assuming my field is real, just a single real scalar field. And so if we want to compute this, then this is just the conjugate of that. When you take the emission conjugate, the bra becomes a ket, and vice versa, and the order changes. And so this thing is integral d3k over 2 pi cubed, 1 over root 2 omega k. And then this is now ak because we've taken the emission conjugate, so that a dagger becomes an a, and then this gets complex conjugated. And so then we just sandwich those two things together. So that was a Y up there. That was presumably relatively obvious. So we sandwich those together. We have to put different labels on the two integrals. So we have, you know what, I'm just going to use the notation where I say K1 tilde. So I'm going to define integral dk tilde to be really the integral d3k over 2 pi cubed, 1 over square root of 2 omega k, so I don't have to keep writing that down. So this is integral dk1 tilde, integral dk2 tilde, and then we have 0, ak1, ak2 dagger, 0, e to the I, k1 dot x minus I, omega 1, T, and these I should implicitly going to make these at a different time. So let me call that x zero, and then e to the minus I k two dot y plus I omega two y zero, and then this thing is simple to calculate because you just use the commutation relations to switch these round, and when you switch them round, you pick up a 2 pi cubed delta 3 k1 minus k2. So you had two integrals, the integral over k1 and integral over k2, but there's a delta function, so you replace with one integral, although there's a hanging over 1 over square root of 2 omega in that, because you each one had a square root of 2 omega. So you have an integral dk1 tilde with an extra 1 over 2 omega k1. So k1 is now k2, so this is I k1 dot x minus y minus I omega k1 x0 minus y0. So this little beauty is called the Whiteman function. It's not the Feynman propagator, because the Feynman propagator is something that's time-ordered. So G Feynman, to the notation U, is the time-ordered product. This is the non-time-ordered product, which is the Whiteman function. And in cosmology, so now there's a central difference. When you learn field theory, you normally learn it from a particle physicist's perspective. And you're always interested in scattering processes. And in scattering processes, you learn these theorems that to calculate scattering amplitudes, essentially I draw down my Feynman diagrams and so on. And the thing that's running in the Feynman diagram is always the Feynman propagator. That's because you're calculating scattering amplitudes. Ultimately, that's because in a scattering amplitude, what you're doing is you're comparing something coming in at minus infinity and something going out at plus infinity. So it's always natural to time order this process. In cosmology, that's not what we do at all. We can really measure this thing. This is going to be, for us, it's going to end up being the temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. So we can, the natural propagators are not the time-ordered things, but the actual expectation values, the so-called Whiteman functions. And we need to use a different formalism, something that you don't learn in field theory textbooks, which is something which is now colloquially known as the Yin-Yin formalism. And maybe later on we'll get to what that precisely is, but probably get to that later. But in the Yin-Yin formalism, there are a greater choice of propagators, because when you learn field theory and for scattering amplitudes, the right propagator is always the Feynman propagator. There's no question about it. But in the Yin-Yin formalism, when you're actually interested in correlation functions at a given time, not at plus infinity or minus infinity, but at a finite time, you'll need to use the Whiteman function, you'll need to use the retarded propagator. All that will get mixed in. So it's a little bit more complicated. But anyway, probably I'll say more about that later. So in... So now the key point is that this thing, when you actually calculate it, is precisely just a function of x minus y squared as promised. So this is truly Lorentz invariant. But if we'd chosen, a different vacuum state here, so that we would have, so in other words, if we'd replaced this thing by... Okay. So there's two ways to say this. So if we'd worked with mode functions vk and vk star, where vk was constructed as a Bogoliubov transform from the positive frequency modes, plus beta k 1 over root 2 omega e to the plus I omega t. So there's a degeneracy here. So we can either say, there's two ways to do things. Either we can say we do the Galyapov transform on the creation annihilation operators, or we say we do it on the choice of mode functions. Is there some questions? It's not in the slightest bit obvious, but you want me to prove it? Yeah, so, okay, let me quickly prove it. So it's simply that, so the best way to prove it is just to write it in a Lorentz invariant way. So this is not obviously a Lorentz invariant because I've got an integral over 3k and I've got the omega on the bottom. So if you want to write in a Lorentz invariant way, what you really want, okay, so let me remind you. So this thing explicitly is integral d3k1 over 2 pi cubed. And then because there was a 1 over square root of 2 omega in this guy and a 1 over square root of 2 omega in that guy, so you got a total 2 omega k1. So we want to write this not obviously Lorentz invariant thing in a way that is obviously Lorentz invariant. This thing is obviously of the sort of e to the I k mu dot x mu minus y mu form. So that's okay, but this bit is not. But you can do it by saying that this integral is really the integral d4k over 2 pi to the 4 times a delta function. Well, let me just consider this integral because I'm not going to get the factors right firsthand. Consider, so suppose we integrate over 4k on the mass shell. So we demand that k squared, and that's the, and by that I mean k mu plus m squared is equal to 0. So this is a delta function that imposes the mass shell condition k mu, k nu plus m squared is 0. And I'm integrating that over 4 momenta. So the key point is that I can split this integral. So this is obviously Lorentz invariant. I hope that's clear, right? So now let me split it up in a non-Lorentz invariant way. This is really integral d3k over 2 pi cubed, integral dk 0. So I separate out the time component of the momenta, times delta, and minus k0 squared plus omega squared, omega k squared, where omega k squared was defined as the spatial momentum squared plus m squared. so we've got to do that integral. Now, the point is you've got a delta function here, but then you're integrating it. So that basically picks out the value where k0 is equal to omega k. Okay, so if we had any function here of k0 inside the integral, the delta function would pick out the value k0 is equal to omega k on the mass shell. And that's precisely what we've got here. We've got k0, that's the Lorentz invariant combination, but k0 is exactly equal to omega k. And there's a measure issue to do with the fact that this is really delta k0 squared. And the way you can figure out the measure is you can say integral dk0 is really 1 half integral dk0 squared over k0 by an application of the chain rule. But because this is multiplied by a delta function, I can say that that k0 is really omega k. And now I've sorted the measure out because now I've just got a delta function in k0 squared, and I'm integrating over k0 squared, and that by definition should give you 1. So this integral here gives you exactly 1 over, there's a 1 over 2 pi, and then an extra 1 over 2 omega k. And that which is this. And there's one subtlety. Can anybody spot the subtlety that I missed? So I made an implicit assumption in doing this, that K0 was positive. But of course, there's actually two solutions of that equation, K0 is plus omega k and K0 is minus omega k. And so what you actually need to do is project out onto the positive cone for K0. And the reason this is still Lorentz invariant is because on the light cone, if K0 is positive in one frame, it remains positive in all frames as long as you do Lorentz transformations that don't change the direction of time. Whatever they're called, like orthochronous Lorentz transformations or something. Yep.
This is Lorentz invariant, but it's not necessarily a function of x minus y squared.
Yeah, because that's the only Lorentz invariant combination I can construct. Pretty much. You're integrating out k, right? K has been integrated out, so this is just a function of x and y. Okay. Yeah?
So did we define a vacuum, or did we figure a way to define phi such that we don't care about what our vacuum actually is?
So we defined, I was calculating this expectation value in the vacuum for which ak0 was 0. So I was assuming that we're in the vacuum defined by ak0 equals 0 to calculate this. Now, I could have started with another vacuum, which is what I'm going to do now, but I'm going to do it in a different order. Okay, so we made a choice of the vacuum that this was true, and then we found that it's Lorentz invariant. Whereas all the other vacua you construct are not Lorentz invariant, essentially. And that's really, the simple way to say that is that these things are functions of k, that has to satisfy mod alpha squared minus mod beta squared is 1. And just because in general they're functions of k, they're going to introduce a preferred length scale and they're going to break Lorentz invariance. It's as simple as that. So when we talk about changing the vacuum, there's two ways to say it, which are sort of redundant. So either I could say I'm going to continue to use the same creation annihilation operators, but I'm going to change my mode functions. So I'm going to do this and take my mode functions to be a superposition of creation annihilation operators. Positive and negative frequency modes. Or I can rewrite that. And this is the same as ak alpha k 1 over root 2 omega k e to the minus I omega t plus beta k 1 over root 2 omega k e to the plus I omega t plus a dagger k alpha k star 1 over root 2 omega k e to the plus I omega t plus beta k star 1 over root 2 omega k e to the minus I omega t. And I can jiggle that around and say, well, actually, this thing is the same as ak alpha k plus beta k. Let me collect together the pieces in front of the positive frequency. So we've got this piece and this piece. I don't like the look of that. Pardon? Which? Oh, I'm sorry. So yeah, I just dropped that out. Yeah, it's because you get e to the I k dot x. Sorry. So combining that together, we have ak alpha k plus beta k star a dagger k times the positive frequency mode. plus, and then we have alpha k star ak dagger plus beta k, a and k times the negative frequency mode. So in other words, I can just say that what I've done is a Bogoliubov transformation directly on the creation annihilation operators, or I could say I've done the Bogoliubov transformation on the mode functions itself. So there's a redundancy in the description. So in practice, what we do is actually we stick with this AK and we view it at the level, the Bogoliubov transformation at the level of the mode functions themselves, because that turns out to be a little easier to deal with. Okay, so far, I mean, you know, these steps in Minkowski space, you know, you don't need to do them, right? Because you're going from one vacuum that's Lorentz invariant to another one that's not, and the preferred vacuum is the one that's Lorentz invariant. So I told you that a symmetry is the natural thing that picks out the vacuum, if there is one. There's another type of symmetry, which is you have more generally, even if you don't have Poincaré invariance, is if there exists a time-like, globally time-like, Killing vector. Because you know, the basic theorem is if you have a globally time-like Killing vector, i.e. something like d by dt, in the metric, suppose we have a metric minus dt squared plus, I'm just going to make something up now, r to the 8, the r squared plus r to the 4 d2 omega. Oh, that's a terrible choice. I'm sorry. Let me choose something like that. So we just take some curved space. This space obviously admits a time-like Killing vector because the metric is invariant under the shift t goes to t plus a constant. And we know whenever we have a globally time-like Killing vector, we have a conserved energy. That energy is the generator associated with the Killing vector. And the point of this, there's now, in such a space-time, there's a well-defined notion of energy, and so there's a well-defined notion, as long as the energy is bounded below, which it better be for a sensible theory, there's a well-defined notion of minimum energy. There's one state which will minimize the energy, E, which is the conjugate to that time-like Killing vector, and that's the natural choice of vacuum. So strictly speaking, we also require that the space-time was globally hyperbolic. Does anyone know what globally hyperbolic means? It basically means there's a well-defined Cauchy problem, and you don't have any sort of singularities in your geometry. So Schwarzschild space, for example, is not globally hyperbolic because you've got a singularity in the space-time, so you know there's some region where it breaks down. You can't have a well-defined Cauchy evolution everywhere. But when you go to cosmology, so that's kind of the minimal thing you need to have a preferred notion of the vacuum state, is a time-like Killing vector. And of course, in the Minkowski space-time case, that's what you had. If you do that calculation in Minkowski space-time, the minimum energy configuration is precisely the one that's Lorentz invariant. So in a curved space-time, let's suppose we now go to FRW space-time. So let's take it to be flat. For simplicity, we have a metric that looks like this. The point is here we have no Killing vector, time-like Killing vector. There are spatial ones, but spatial ones are not going to give you a notion of energy and not going to give you a natural notion of vacuum. So there's no time-like Killing vector. So this is one way to say why you can get particle creation on a time-dependent space-time, Because there is no notion of energy. There's no conserved notion of energy. And the thing that forbids you to just create particles from vacuum in empty space is that energy has to be conserved. So if you have no energy, you can't suddenly create a particle because that has to have some positive energy. But in a curved space-time, which is explicitly time-dependent, there is no notion of energy. And so there's nothing to forbid you creating a particle out of vacuum. Does that make sense?
This is based on defining energy as the generator of these translations.
That is the definition of energy. The global energy. I'm talking about a global, not energy density now, I'm talking about global energy. The only notion of energy you have is when you have a globally time-like Killing vector. Yeah?
So, on a spacetime like this, so you imagine that locally you would have see something like conservation of energy because it's locally flat.
You have a local conservation of energy, so obviously, you know, you have d mu, t mu nu is zero. But what you'd like to do is define some global notion of energy, like E is integral d3x t0, 0, something like that. Right, where you take the integrals off to infinity. But this thing is only conserved, so it's only true that E dot equals 0 if you have a globally time-like Killing vector. And that's something to do with the asymptotics of the space-time, so the asymptotics inside this integral. To have a notion of energy, a well-defined notion of energy, you always have to have a globally time-like Killing vector. Now I can write you, and it's important it's global, so De Sitter space-time, for example, is a great example where there is a locally defined Killing vector, time-like Killing vector, but not a globally defined one. And we can just see that very quickly. So the metric for De Sitter space can be written in many different ways, but if the most relevant way to doing cosmology is the spatially flat slicing, where De Sitter space looks like this. So we've got an exponentially expanding space, so the scale factor A of t goes as e to ht. Now in this form, it's clear that this metric does not admit a time-like Killing vector because it's explicitly dependent on time. But you know, you have to work a little harder than that because, you know, I can take Minkowski space and do some weird coordinate transformation and make it look like it's not obvious that it has a time-like Killing vector. So, and here, I can do a few coordinate transformations that make it look clear that this space-time actually does admit a time-like Killing vector. So to do that, let me take this thing and put it in spherical polars. So that's an S2. So I'm at some point r, and I'm going to use spherical polar coordinates to measure the distance in space away from me. And now, the real distance is not r, but it's the distance times the scale factor. So that essentially r here is what we call the co-moving distance. But the physical distance, r, is the scale factor A of t times the co-moving distance, r. So just in the same way that physical wavelengths go as the scale factor A of t times the co-moving wavelength. So let's jiggle this equation around a bit. So I can rewrite it. ds squared is minus dt squared plus e to the 2ht times dr, which I now write as r over e to the ht squared plus r squared over to e to the 2ht d2 omega, s2. And this is easy to see as the same as dr minus hdt squared plus r squared d2 omega s2. So in this form, it's now clear this space-time admits a killing vector where t goes to t plus a constant. Because this thing is a constant, and t only enters in the form dt inside the metric. Now what we normally do is then do another coordinate transformation. So but it's got a kind of annoying cross term. When you square this out, you can have an annoying cross term. Sorry, I missed an R there. So multiplying out that square, you really have ds squared is minus 1 minus h squared r squared dt squared. There's minus 2r dr h dt plus r squared h squared. Plus dr squared plus r squared to 2 omega s2. So we'd like to get rid of this cross term. We can do that very simply by defining a new variable t, which is t plus the integral of h r dr over 1 minus h squared r squared. Okay, let me define that quantity. The logic in that is that dt is dt plus hr over 1 minus h squared r squared dr. And so this thing you can show looks exactly like 1 minus h squared r squared dt squared plus dr squared over 1 minus h squared r squared plus r squared d2 omega s2. Now this thing is called the static slicing of the set of space, static coordinates. And it's called static because in these coordinates it's manifest that t goes to t plus a constant is a killing vector. It's just clear from that metric it's a killing vector. Now you see, though, where the problem is. This is only time-like when 1 minus h squared r squared is greater than 0, greater than equal to 0. Because that's the coefficient of dt squared, so we know if dt is really a time variable, the coefficient in front of it must be positive. Now, the distance, the physical distance, r, so that requires that r is less than or equal to h minus 1. But if you remember that h minus 1 was the curvature scale, what you're doing is saying, you know, I'm an observer at r equals 0. I have a horizon around me whose size in de Sitter is exactly h minus 1. And with inside my horizon, this quantity is positive, and I have a well-defined notion of energy. Because there's a, and I look, think I'm going to have a well-defined notion of energy. But this is not globally time-like, because for r bigger than h minus 1, this switches sign, and it becomes a space-like killing vector. So in de Sitter space, although there is a time-like killing vector, there is no well-defined notion of energy. And again, I mean a global energy, not a local energy density. And that's something that's going to be very important to understand the origin of why an observer in vacuum, in de Sitter space, sees a thermal spectrum of radiation, which is something we're going to get to calculate. So So back to the general FRW case. Okay, now let's do our quantization procedure. Suppose we start with a massive scalar field. Is there any questions about that, Achie? Am I going too fast or too slow?
So what you say here is that there is a locally defined Killing vector, but that's it's not global.
It's not global, so it's well defined in this condition. It's time-like, but then it becomes space-like outside, and on the boundary it's null. On the horizon it's null, which makes sense because it's a true event horizon. An event horizon should be a null surface.
So the conclusion is that there is no conservation of energy.
Exactly. There's no well-defined notion of energy conservation. There's no globally defined energy. And that's why, ultimately, that's going to be why, even in the vacuum, we see the thermal spectrum of particles. So let's take a massive scalar field in FRW. So the action for that, d4x root minus g minus a half gab dA phi dB phi minus a half m squared phi squared. We could have been doing m squared phi squared inflation, for example. That's what we would be dealing with. So plugging in that form of the metric, actually, I think I'm going to put it in conformal time, just to be awkward. So you can rewrite this metric in this form, where this thing is called conformal time. And it's nice because there the metric is then just conformal, up to a conformal factor, it's proportional to Minkowski space-time. And in cosmology, we'll do this trick all the time, switching, we like non-stop switching back and forth between proper time and conformal time. In conformal time, root minus g is a to the 4. And when you work this out, but when you invert the metric, you get a 1 over a squared. So what you get is something that looks like minus a half a squared dA d phi squared. I'm going to tell you what that is in a second. Minus a half m squared a to the 4 phi squared. Whereby this thing, I'm now going to use the notation that d phi squared really means minus d eta phi squared plus grad phi squared. So this is the kinetic term as you would have had it on this conformally related Minkowski space-time. And now we've taken out the conformal factor, put it here, and put it here. Unfortunately, it doesn't come in with the same coefficient, but such is life. So this is the kind of equation we'll be seeing all the time when we do inflationary perturbation theory. And these things, of course, are explicit dependent on time. And in this form, its equation of motion looks a bit messy. But there's a nice trick to simplify it, which, again, we're going to do all the time, which is to say, so in some sense, you know, if you think what comes inside a path integral, it's e to the is over h bar. Now, we've always been setting h bar as 1, but that's really what comes in, is the action measured in units of h bar. So let's consider that quantity s over h bar and put the h bars back in. In some sense here, the scale factor squared is playing the role of 1 over h bar. Okay, so in other words, what I mean by that is, let's suppose you make the scale factor bigger. That's making the coefficient in front of the kinetic term bigger. But that's exactly the same thing that would happen if I made h bar smaller. So we know that our intuition is that h bar is 0, we're in the classical limit. So the smaller we make h bar, then the more classical we become. Here, that's roughly equivalent to making A larger. So we might expect an intuition that as the scale factor increases, we become more classical. Conversely, as the scale factor decreases, that's equivalent to making H bar larger. That kind of argument is used all the time in field theory. So Now the trick we're going to use is basically to absorb, redefine our fields and absorb the value of the scale factor inside. So let me define U is A times phi. Phi is that 1 over AU. So then this thing is the only thing that depends on time. So we have d eta phi is going to be 1 over A d eta U minus A prime over A squared U, where A prime is the shorthand notation for a BA d eta. Remember that eta is conformal time, so this prime is still a time derivative. It's not a space derivative. Whereas for the gradient, because A is just a function of time, this is simply 1 over A eta gradient of U. So we do this trick, just a field redefinition. Physics is invariant in a field redefinition, so I can do these tricks at will in practice. And then the action becomes minus a half, and then we have, so it's going to be, there's an a squared outside, and then there's minus 1 over a d eta u minus a prime over a squared u squared. So that's plus. No, it's minus. Plus grad u over a squared. And then the last term is simple to transform. That's just minus a half m squared a squared u squared. Everyone see that down there? It's a bit low. So we did this definition because there was an a squared out front, that there's a 1 over a here inside, which gets squared, and so is going to precisely cancel. And so the point of that redefinition is to get rid of this weird fact about the scale factor being in front and that changing the value of h-bar. And this process is called canonical. We usually just call it canonical normalization of the scalar field. And the point is to make the scalar field look as close as possible to what it does in Minkowski spacetime. So the action is, so it's plus a half d eta u minus a prime over a u squared minus a half grad u squared minus a half m squared a squared u squared. Now this is still not as simple as we'd like to make it. We've got rid of the scale factor up front, but we've paid the price of this annoying square, which is going to have a cross term. So let's multiply this thing out. This gives you a half d eta u squared minus 2 a prime over a d eta u, and then plus a prime over a squared u squared minus a half grad u squared minus a half m squared a squared u squared. So I'll put the whole action. Now this piece just looks like a mass term like this one. But this piece is the annoying one. It's kind of first order derivatives. But we can do now just integration by parts by using the fact that d eta u, 2 d eta u, eta u is just the same as d eta u squared. So this guy here is just minus a prime over a d eta u squared. Just this piece. And then I integrate this guy by parts, so I can take the time derivative acting on the u squared, I can put it on here, but I switch the sign in the process. So that same piece, after an integration by parts, looks like that. Is that clear to everybody? So it's just a general thing. Whenever you only have a first order time derivative in the action, you can always do that integration by parts and make it look like a mass term. So the end product is an equation. After all this jiggling about, looks like 1/2 d eta u squared minus 1/2 grad u squared minus 1/2 m squared effective, which is a function of eta u squared. So I've just collected all those pieces that go like u squared, such as this one, such as this one, such as this one. Collected them together and called them an effective mass, which is a function of time, m squared a squared eta. So that's the original mass now rescaled with the scale factor. There's this piece, which comes in with the opposite sign, minus a prime over a squared. And then this piece as well that also comes in with the opposite sign, minus d eta a prime over a. And it shouldn't be too hard to see that this is the same as that. Because when you differentiate, this piece gives you that. Differentiate the bottom, it gives you this with the opposite sign and cancels out. So we have here a great simple result, which is that a massive scalar field, in FRW is identically equivalent, after a field redefinition, to a scalar field in Minkowski space, i.e. the conformally related Minkowski space, with a time-dependent mass. So the, in practice, in FRW, the only complication comes from the fact that the mass ends up effectively being a function of time. And again, there's here, although this bit looks like the kinetic term on Minkowski space, again, there's still no conserved energy because the mass is not constant. So it's like it's like looking at a scalar field in an external source, which is time dependent. And so again, the reason you can have particle creation is because the external source is time dependent and effectively pumps energy into the system, allowing the possibility of creating particles. Okay, so in the problem for the tutorials this afternoon, essentially you're going to solve a very simple problem for a situation with the time-dependent mass and use that to calculate the total number of particles you create. And what's going to happen is so let's suppose we have a situation where m squared effective eta goes to a constant at minus infinity and goes to a constant at plus infinity, or minus infinity goes to a constant at plus infinity, but is a function of time in between. So if we plot it out, maybe it does something like it's a constant, and then you've got a bump, and then it goes back to a constant again. In the regime where you've got a constant, you've got a well-defined notion of particles, d defined by waves coming in which are positive frequency, where here the frequency is defined with respect to the mass at minus infinity. Coming out, you also have a well-defined notion of frequency, of positive frequency, omega tilde t, where now omega tilde is defined by k squared plus m squared at plus infinity. But in the middle, in general, you'll have some time dependence as you go through in time here. So you take something that's the vacuum coming in with modes defined just by the positive frequency, but as you evolve through this non-adiabatic regime, and in the simple example in the problems, you'll just be able to do this analytically, and you match through to the other side, what if you send in just a positive frequency mode coming in, what comes out is really, is it going to be a mix of positive and negative frequency modes for a given k. And it's essentially like this kind of scattering problems you've done in quantum mechanics, except slightly different. So in quantum mechanics, you know, you do some problem where you have a potential hill or something like that. You send in a particle here. Some of it gets transmitted. Some gets reflected. So on this side, you have a mode coming in this way and coming out. Here, you just have a mode going that way. In this problem, you send in, here we're going now evolving in time rather than space, you send in a positive frequency mode, you have some non-adiabatic situation, and what comes out is a mix of positive and negative frequency modes. And the number of particles is basically proportional to mod beta squared. But otherwise, the technique is the same. So anyway, I've gone over, so I'll have to stop there. Okay. any questions? Whilst you still got me?